March is Women's History Month, and Paul Bunyan Broadcasting is teaming up with the United Way of Bemidji Area, Women United, and the Beltrami County Historical Society to celebrate the legendary women of Beltrami County. And that includes with the Living United podcast. This month, we'll have weekly podcasts featuring women who have made huge impacts in Beltrami County and the women who are making tomorrow's Beltrami County history today. The Legendary Women of Beltrami County is presented by First National Bank Bemidji and North Homes. And we will hear from the Legendary Women of Beltrami County next.
At First National Bank Bemidji, you can think of us as your neighbor, because we are. You can see it in the familiar faces when you stop in. You hear it in the friendly voice when you call. Our prompt service and local decisions inspire trust to handle your biggest dreams. Whether you're buying a home or opening your first checking account, work with the bank that knows what community really means. First National Bank Bemidji. Better together. Member FDIC.
Hi, I'm Danae Alamano, and this is Living United.
And I'm Kev Jackson. It's a special series of Living United podcasts for Women's History Month as we're celebrating the legendary women of Beltrami County, presented by First National Bank Bemidji and North Homes Children and Family Services. And Danae Alamano, who is our legendary woman of Beltrami County this time?
Yes, our future woman of history is Sue Kringen.
Sue Kringen, who is a community everything.
Extraordinary. Yes, has done so much in the Bemidji area. And Sue, thanks for joining us.
Yep, that'd be Sue Altman Kringen, because the Altman name precedes me before I married.
Oh,
which
yes.
I'm very proud of that name.
I understand that.
Yes, as well you should be. So, Danae, I'll let you toss the first question to her, since she is a former United Way Executive Director.
The first full-time United Way Executive Director, and you have the present, so look
yes.
at that, all that history in between there.
I know.
Sue, can you talk about your time at United Way when you started?
Well, I started within the first year it was created. It was created by another community leader, Suzanne Leopas, along with Kevin Cease. They had gone to a Blandon Leadership Workshop conference, and they were challenged to come back to their local communities, all the participants, and initiate something. And Kevin and Suzanne started the United Way. I give them complete credit for it. And they were in need of a director, and Kevin, when I graduated from college, I went to work at Northern National Bank under the Honorable Bill Howe, who we just lost, unfortunately. But one day, Kevin was at my desk, and he was talking about the United Way, because he was on their board at the time. And I said, Kevin, you know what? I might be interested in that job. He said, really? And so I left. It was a risk. I mean, you have to understand there was no history. So it was creating something from the bottom up. I was leaving a full-time job, salaried with benefits, to a completely part-time job, even though the hours required, I worked a lot more than that. And I was willing to do that because I realized if there was any future of the United Way, I needed to invest my time. And here we are today with you guys just reaching this amazing goal of 800,000?
Well,
the first year that I was director, I think we raised 84,000, and I was so disappointed. I wanted to break 100. So look at how far we've come. It's amazing.
I was going to say, it is amazing. And when you look at you as a part-time person, housed where at the time? Where was the headquarters of the United Way in those days?
The new people in Bemidji won't even be able to identify with this, but we were in the basement of the old Chamber of Commerce building, which was on the hill right by the stoplights by Paul and Babe. And at one end of it was the museum, and they were attached. And then you could drive down and go underneath, and there was a basement. It was a challenging environment. They had just finished off the offices. I shared an office with a walkthrough with the Visitors and Convention Bureau. There was no indoor plumbing. I had to go outside to the restrooms to get water, to make coffee. It was challenging, but you know what? I knew that going in. I remember walking in that door that first day thinking, oh my gosh, what have I done? And then I bit my lip and I thought, no, Sue, you made the decision. You're going to make it work. And it did. It was one of the most rewarding experiences of my life. Because like I shared with Danae earlier, it was a a difficult decision for me to ultimately leave United Way because I really, really felt I was making a difference in people's lives, and many times at the most basic levels. I'd go into businesses representing agencies, speaking out when we were short an agency, mm-hmm. and I would be sharing stories and I would be in tears. But that's the impact it had on me.
Wow. And then so we go from there. Those humble beginnings to your own building now yeah. and a staff of, what did you tell me?
Four and a half.
Yeah. And making a lot of impacts now in so many ways and a number of programs that you guys actually created. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's been quite a journey for this group. And I think it's worth noting every single executive director, I believe, of the United Way has been a woman.
Mm-hmm. That is true.
That is true.
You hear about women not being in leadership positions in other professional areas, but that hasn't been the case with the United Way.
Not at all.
We're so compassionate as women.
Well, it's fun too. You know, I've talked to Sue many times now, but she'll bring up pieces that, you know, still exist, whether it's you talked last time I spoke with you, you talked about Dondelinger starting their workplace campaign. They mm-hmm. still run, and we have even better partnership with now. Mm-hmm. Or are you talking about Bill Howe? He was a wonderful donor to United Way, even just last year. Those pieces that those foundational pieces she started still exist, which is pretty amazing.
I remember after our first campaign, because I was focused everything on the campaign, and at the end I realized that we had to have a victory celebration, and that was like an afterthought. So we threw it together. It was successful, but it was at the upstairs at the Eagles Club, not the Eagles, the Elks Lodge.
The Elks Club.
I'm
sure.
Sorry.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, which is also.
Got another
place now.
Part of history is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So that's there's been a lot of changes in the United Way, and it all started well before Sue Kringen, but you really did give it a good kickstart.
She launched it. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I'm proud of that.
Well, that's only one chapter of your amazing life of mm-hmm. action. What are some of the other things you've been involved in over the years?
Well, after United Way, I was with United Way for 5 years. I was asked to apply for a position at BSU. I ultimately was the assistant to the vice president for university advancement, and then I was alumni director. So I led the alumni association for 8 years, and then I went over to the foundation, was a fundraiser for another 7 because I was up there for 15 years. While I was up there, I was involved in a lot of university committees. And I was in Rotary, and I tell people I joined Rotary for all the wrong reasons. My dad was ill. He had dementia, and he couldn't drive anymore, and that really bothered him. But he was a very, very loyal Rotarian. So I said, Dad, I'll make sure you get to Rotary. So I joined Rotary. Mm-hmm. And again, that was an amazing experience. I went on. I was president of Rotary. I went to Honduras on a goodwill adventure, is what I call it, for 2 weeks. And along with being a proud person of a proud member of that organization. I was president, and while I was president, the Boys and Girls Club was built, and I had to rally the troops, the members, to dig in their pockets, to make donations, to buy computers, which were, I think the room at the Rotary Club is now named the Rotary Room, the Bemidji Rotary Room, I believe. But it was, again, that was another great experience.
She just seems to have a knack, doesn't she?
Right. Major knack. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So you did that. You were at Bemidji State for a number of years?
Yeah, I went to Bemidji State. I graduated. My undergraduate degree was in Phi Ed Health and Rec, if you can believe it.
Mine, too.
It really? Is that not amazing?
PE and health. Look at that.
My dad tried to talk me out of that. And for one quarter, I went elementary ed because back in those days, there was a shortage of teachers. Mm-hmm. And he said, where are you going to get a job? And I said, I don't know. But my passion was Phi Ed Health and Rec. Mm-hmm. And then when I graduated, I couldn't find a job. So I went into banking. And I always said, the Lord has a answer, and you just have to trust in the Lord. And that career path was the best thing that ever happened to me because it propelled me to go to another job position that was great. Another position was great, and back to banking, where I retired from.
Okay. And Bemidji State, again, speaking of making impacts, that was kind of your job there too.
Absolutely, it was. And part of my job, I call it public relations. When I was with alumni, I made a lot of great friends and relationships. But my responsibility was to create an environment to invite them back to campus so that they could relive the memories, the great memories of going to Bemidji State University. And that kind of laid the foundation for the foundation to work with them to consider major gift donations to the foundation. But that was, I really enjoyed that opportunity. I worked with, when I came there, we had one person nominated for Outstanding Alumni Award. And I said, this is not acceptable. And so I worked to ramp that up. Plus, another thing I did when we were talking earlier about women in United Way, there were no women nominees. And I said, then that's our responsibility to make sure women are represented. So we went after that side of it. And again, it was extremely successful. I also worked with the Athletic Hall of Fame, building that up to the program it is today. And I mean, it was there before, but I think I was able to pull in resources and volunteers to make it really a great organization. I'm pretty proud of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a big deal.
Yeah. So you've been on a lot of different boards and committees and things. Maybe name a few. And what was there one that really stood out to you as you helped our community become what it is?
You know, that goes way back. I was treasurer of the Salvation Army when I was with the United Way. But I think I was president of the Bemidji Chamber of Commerce. And that was very rewarding. The year I was president, we went over to Superior to witness and watch the dragon boat races there to see if that was a venture that we wanted to put our toe in. Came back totally energized. And then the next year, we introduced the dragon boat races to Bemidji. Hmm. I was also on the United Way board twice, which was a great, of course, experience.
You want a third stint?
Well, you know what? You have to be careful with that because you don't want somebody on that your boards, because I experienced that once when I was at the university, that says, well, we used to do it this way. Mm-hmm. And you have to be a visionary to say, well, it worked then, but let's think about how to make it better. Mm-hmm. So that was another great, great, great experience for me as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the interesting things is that you have been in the Bemidji area your entire life.
And I have.
Have you ever been tempted to leave, or is this just the place you want to be?
You know, when I married my husband, Kurt, we agreed that we were going to make our home in Bemidji, and he has worked, I think I can say this, at Lukens for 55 years.
Wow.
And I'm grateful. I met Kurt working at Lukens, by the way, with Joe Luken, and I thought the world of him, and he was so supportive of me. I ran for Miss Bemidji once, and I had to get my own sponsor, and I hesitant and nervously went up to Joe, and I said, I have to get this amount of money. I can't remember what it was then. I think $100 for him to sponsor me, and he said, absolutely.
Aww, amazing.
I was second runner-up, but I was too short. I was told that by one of the judges.
Wow,
I was too short at the time. Mm-hmm. So, again, that was a great experience, and Joe was so loyal to me over the years. I introduced him to our then president of the board of director, Jim Benson, was the president of the university, and I said, you know, somebody you should consider getting on the foundation board is Joe Luken, and he is so grateful to Bemidji State University for all the great employees that he's been able to hire over the years through the university, as well as the recognition of the economic impact that BSU had on the community. So they did get him on the board, and as you all probably know, the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Wow.
Yeah.
So what is it about the Bemidji area that appeals to you?
You know, we talk about giving. One of the things is I think Bemidji is, if not the lead, one of the lead communities in the state of Minnesota for people that are generous with their time, talent, and treasure. And that's always impressed me. I used to travel quite a bit when I was with the foundation. I'd fly all over the United States because I had to go where the alumni who had the capacity to make a major gift lived. That meant big cities and no GPS in cars driving rentals. But I always tell people the best part of my job of doing that traveling was sitting at the gate on time, ready to come back home to Bemidji, because I loved it. And I've told people that you will find nobody in Bemidji that loves Bemidji or is more loyal to Bemidji than me. It's quality of life.
Yeah.
You know, I know you're retired now, but that does not mean you're not still doing community work.
Right.
I'm involved with you in your newest venture for our community. Can you share a little bit about that?
Well, I have a sister that a lot of people may know as well. Her name is Kay Mack, and she's retired. And she was recently asked to take on the opportunity to chair the Capital Campaign Cabinet to build a new building for the Northwoods Battered Women's Shelter. Well, Kay knew I had a background in fundraising, so she called me. And how do you say no to your sister, number one? But I think I was, at that time, it was perfect time for me because I needed something to take pride in again, to get satisfaction out of since I retired. So I said, yeah, I'll help out. Their campaign goal is $3.2 million. We've raised a little over, not we, there was money there when I joined, but now this is the hard part. This is where the boots hit the ground. We are up to $2 million. Mm-hmm. So I'm making asks. They've written grants, and I'm also volunteered. I have a hard time saying that word, N-O, but I volunteered to chair a committee that's organizing a miniature golf tournament out at the boardwalk. It is a go. I am really proud to say Paul Bunyan Broadcasting has agreed to be one of the major corporate sponsors. Mm-hmm. We're having at the boardwalk, and it's going to be called the Boardwalk Mini Golf Classic, scheduled for June 9th. We're still working out details. We're going to have three rounds, great prizes, and it'll be a great... The goals of the tournament are to, of course, raise money for the project, but also to create awareness about the need. The building that they're in right now is a travesty. It's an embarrassment. Like I said, I'm proud of Bemidji, but that building is nothing that Bemidji can take any pride in at all. It's not handicap accessible. It's completely broken up. People come in there, they don't have any privacy because they have to share rooms. And it's the new architectural drawing of the future building is absolutely phenomenal, and everybody will be very proud of to call that home to women, families, and men that are in domestic abusive situations that require they get help. Mm-hmm. Did I say it good enough?
Job. Okay.
So, I mean, obviously, we can help by being part of the classic, but others listening right now might want to go ahead and proactively contribute. So how can they do that?
Well, they can go to the Northwest... Northwoods Battered Women's Shelter online website. I think it's NWBS.
Yeah.
Thank you. And in the middle of their homepage is a link to Capital Campaign. They can go on that link, and at the bottom of that page, there's a pledge form that you can fill out that would you can make a pledge or give money directly to the shelter. Mm-hmm. And they would most gratefully accept it. It's like I said, it's a need that it speaks for itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In the famous 80-20 rule, she is one of the 20 doing the 80.
Oh. Right? She definitely is.
Yeah.
You guys are too sweet.
What drives you to do everything that you do, Sue?
You know, I think I've told people this goes way back to when I was a kid. I was, there were eight siblings. I was the second oldest and the oldest daughter. And there was an expectation from my mom and dad that I'd help mom out with the kids. So I helped raise my younger sisters, and we're part of a team, and it was just an expectation. And if you didn't follow through, there were consequences. Mm-hmm. And we had a small family resort out in Bisida, and I was cleaning cabins by myself when I was in third grade. Wow. And I look at that, but again, I didn't question it. It was just what we were expected to do. Again, because I lived out at Bisida, we couldn't logistically afford or justify the kids being involved in any extracurricular activities in Bemidji. And I wanted that so bad. Mm-hmm. We moved to Crookston. My dad started teaching. We lived in town, and I totally immersed myself in activities. I won't go on all of them, but it was a lot of fun. I was had the lead in our school play. I was a cheerleader. I was a thespian, if you know what a thespian is.
I do.
And I love it. And I think that sense of pride and sense of satisfaction that I got out of participating in all those activities, it's just what drew me to continue to do that. And I think that also a thing that I got as a child is the positive outlook that my mom and dad gave us. Never say never. There's nothing you can't accomplish. And I think that translated over to my personal and private and professional life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Oh, thank you.
So you're definitely a woman, I just tell by her praise, that has been a big influence on Danae, mm-hmm. and that she admires. So outside of your parents, because that's the obvious answer, who's a woman in Beltrami County history that really influenced you and that you admire?
Well, I think one of the women earliest would be Rosemary Given-Amble. She was the first woman on the city council, but she walked the talk. She was really involved. She, I think, led the centennial celebration from Bemidji, mm-hmm. and I truly admired her. Beyond that, you know, there weren't a lot of women leaders up until the last decade or two in Bemidji. So it would be just within the organizations that I participated in. When I was with the chamber, it was men that were directing it way back then. Mm-hmm. So I think Rosemary, or it was just the circumstances that I worked for the right men that encouraged me, supported me, pushed me, because they saw in me way more than I saw in myself. I never saw myself as a leader, but they did. And that's that was a gift back then.
Okay.
Amazing.
Yes. Yes. Anything else from either one of you? It's been quite a story.
No, look for the news on the Boardwalk Golf Mini Golf Classic.
Okay.
Be fun to have a group where it's, like I say, there's two goals. One is awareness, one is raising money, and it's going to be a family-friendly event.
Mm-hmm. Well, from my perspective, I don't want to just thank you for breaking glass ceilings in the Bemidji area. I want to thank you and Kay for breaking the bias against short people.
Oh, yeah.
That's really important.
So you're most welcome, Kevin. Gosh, that was easy for me.
Sue, thank you for everything you do for our community. You are an inspiration.
Well, as are you, Danae, so thank you.
We'll let one of the legendary women in this conversation, Sue Kringen, go, but we'll keep Danae around. We've got another guest to talk to next.
North Homes Children and Family Services is seeking licensed alcohol and drug counselors to provide outpatient services at our Bemidji Clinic. Our substance use disorder program serves both adolescents and adults. North Homes provides comprehensive assessments, weekly group and individual sessions, and we also participate in specialty courts and multidisciplinary teams. We offer a flexible schedule, generous benefits, and PTO. Our continuum of care allows us to provide whole person care while connecting to additional supportive services. We need your passion. Come grow with us today. To apply, please visit northhomes.org.
We are back with part two of this week's edition of Living United, the special Legendary Women of Beltrami County edition. And Danae Alamano, who is our latest legend?
Another woman I admire from afar, Rebecca Hoffman, is with us today. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you.
So what makes Rebecca a legendary woman of Beltrami County?
A lot of things. So I'm excited for her to share, but her work with Village of Hope, and also she chaired, well, I can let you share more, but she works at BSU and does a lot for students going into social work to really know what they're getting into and be equipped to work in social work.
All right. Well, Rebecca, tell us a little bit about that. What are the things you're doing at BSU? Not much right now. You're taking a sabbatical, but in general, what have you been up to the last few years?
Well, this has been an exciting next chapter in my career after Village of Hope, really looking at taking all those lessons learned from the field and bringing them to the classroom and helping students kind of find their footing and their passion for social work practice. Social work is just such a broad field. It includes so many different facets of practice. And so when students are interested in making the world a little bit of a better place, we get to come alongside them and help them figure out how they want to do that.
Okay. So let's go back to the Village of Hope. Were you the person behind getting that thing built to begin with?
Yes.
I think you were.
That was my deal. Yes.
And it wasn't called the Village of Hope in those days. So let's go back to the beginning.
Okay.
What was your vision? How did you get that vision? And what happened?
Well, as I was graduating from Bemidji State University quite a few decades ago now, there was this tiny little ad in the Northern Student for an executive director of Hours to Serve House of Hospitality. Paid $6,000 a year, 10 to 20 hours a week. It was one of those things that you pretty much only do right as you're leaving college. And I looked at it as, okay, this is going to be an extension of my education here. And it really was. So I was there for a few years and really just learned the ropes. I realized I was a social worker. I had a political science degree initially. So I went back to college, got my master's in social work, and was living in Wisconsin for about 6 years, but always just had this place in my heart for the House of Hospitality. And at that time, it was a homeless shelter for men, women, and families with children. It was right across from the post office in this tiny little building, just not an adequate space. There was lots of talk about, you know, we need to do something about this little shelter and make it bigger and help it to adequately serve the community. So when we moved back to Bemidji back in 2005, one of the first things that I did was get on the new facility committee. And I was raising a couple of tiny children at that time. And eventually another director left the agency and I went back to my old job as the director of the House of Hospitality. And I just kind of kept telling everybody, and I'm here to build a new shelter. I had no idea what I was doing or how I was going to do it. And it did dawn on me several times, like I maybe am just a little bit out there telling everybody I'm here to build a new shelter. Because at that time, there wasn't even a funding source in Minnesota for new shelter capital funds. Mm-hmm. Back in the 80s, the Twin Cities and metro areas got their shelters, and then the funding streams shifted to transitional housing, then permanent supportive housing. So I actually had to create a funding source in order to build the shelter. And it was really, it was kind of an exciting process looking back, but I was reaching out to Tim Flathers and Jim Helter, who was, you know, a great local politician. And he's like, you got to talk to Frank Moe, who was then our state rep. And so I called Frank Moe's office and said I'd like to meet. I hear you're coming to Bemidji next week. And so he met with me and graciously at the end of that meeting said, I'm going to be with you till the end on this project. Wow. And I just kind of was like, okay, I think something big just happened here. And it did. So he authored legislation to create a funding source for emergency shelter capital needs to the tune of $1 million. And lo and behold, we had social work students and lots of folks from Bemidji and the region writing letters of support and doing lots of lobbying around this bill that Frank Moe introduced. And it passed the bonding session that year. And so on the day that the bill got signed, he called me up and he was like, all right, we've got a shelter project in the works. It required a lot of collaboration from local government. It had to be publicly owned. So the Beltrami County Housing Redevelopment Commission actually owns the building. It needed local funding. And at that time, the city council had a moratorium on funding nonprofits. So I met with one of the city council members who was most aligned with that ideology and just said, we need your funding in order to make this happen. And because the money goes to Minnesota Housing, and then our agency had to apply to Minnesota Housing to get that bonding money for the shelter. So the city council found some UDEG funds to help, you know, provide that local support. The Nielsen Foundation kicked in $100,000. Like, everybody just started kind of circling around. Red Lake Housing put in the very first $50,000. And eventually we had the funding from Minnesota Housing and we had a shelter project.
Wow.
That's a long and winding road, as the Beatles would say.
Right, yes.
How long did it take to, you said you came back to town in 2005? How long was the project?
Six years from start of getting on the committee to actually opening up Village of Hope. Yeah, it was a long process. I was running the shelter at the same time as working on this new project. And those were some of the most challenging and most satisfying days and years of my career.
I think, speaking of decades, I think I was on what was then called the United Way Allocations Committee.
Sure.
When they were in the old place, and I got a tour, I think probably from you.
Probably.
Wow. Yeah.
So.
So you remember.
I do.
The humble beginnings.
Yeah. I just, when you think about it, it's like, how did you even make that work?
Right. There was no air conditioning. The heating system was ancient. There were all sorts of challenges just with the physical environment. But one of the great things about working there all those years was then translating that pain into a new vision for, okay, what can a shelter look like ideally? And I think we accomplished that with Village of Hope for the most part. And there's always room to grow and make it better, but I used to get called into work at about 11:30, 12 o'clock at night frequently because somebody wouldn't show up for the night shift.
Mm.
And so you had little kids, and that's a hardship when you are getting called into work in the middle of the night. One week it happened 3 times in the same week. And so I'm watching the sun come up, and a bunch of the guys that were staying at the shelter, they're sitting there having coffee with me. And I just said, okay, what do other shelters do? Like, I can't do this. And they're like, you need somebody who lives on site here. And I was like, you are absolutely right. And so it's actually, that was a design element that came from some of the users of the shelter saying, you need some on-site staff. And so we ended up incorporating 4 on-site apartments into Village of Hope. People live there in exchange for working, I believe, 10 days a month. And so it provides housing. It alleviates some of the additional expense of running the new shelter because payroll is the biggest expense.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it alleviated that burnout cycle. We had, you know, a lot of turnover in directors, and incorporating housing into the new design. Sandy Henham, she was my successor. So, she was there for over 10 years. And so that was a huge win. Every year that she was there on her work anniversary, I'd be like, that's another win for that new shelter facility.
Yeah.
Just because it alleviated a lot of the pressure of running it 24/7, 365 days a year.
I think one of the other things about Village of Hope and shelters in general, I think a lot of people don't realize that there's people there that are not just open the door, giving them a bed. They're trying to help them too. I mean, they're trying to help them with next steps,
right?
Which is a really, really important thing,
right? So, looking at, you know, what can be done when somebody's homeless, finding housing is a huge deal, obviously. But the funding for housing, and there are oftentimes so many complicating factors surrounding homelessness. So we partnered with Bi-County CAP to provide a case manager to work on site at Village of Hope to just help kind of provide those wraparound services and connections, you know, individualized to every family that was living there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as we were building Village of Hope, we made the decision to make it a family shelter. So prior to this, it had been a shelter for men, women, and families with children, and one of the limitations was we just couldn't serve everybody under one roof. And our hope was that in creating that boundary, other organizations or folks would step in and fill that gap in the community then, which they have. I love the work that People's Church has done over the years, and now Reed Olson and the Wolf Center and the Nameless Coalition for the Homeless. They've all come and filled that need that was created, you know, as we were trying to figure out, like, how much can one agency do here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how did you get to Bemidji? I mean, you mentioned that you went into political science at first and realized you're a social worker. So what got you to Bemidji?
I came here on a camping trip with my dad and our foreign exchange student, Hannah. We actually had gone up to Canada, and then we were coming down through Bemidji, and we stopped at Lake Bemidji State Park, and Han and I took the camper into town while my dad stayed back at the campsite. We were ready to, you know, we were 17 and 18, ready to check out Bemidji, and it was love at first sight, I can honestly say. I drove by BSU, and I was like, that's the place for me, and I have felt that this was my home ever since. We left for 8 years and we went to Wisconsin for grad school, and loved moving back here again after that, and just have always felt this is my home. And ironically, and really a neat thing, is Hannah has a daughter, Maya. Maya Rebecca Sandalowski is going to come and live with us in the 24-25 academic year as a foreign exchange student. So we're going to have kind of a full circle moment there, too.
That's really neat. And where are you? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New London, about four hours south of here. So, yeah, went to Bemidji State University. I loved being a student at BSU. Loved how accessible everything was to all students at BSU. I love now being an educator at BSU, having been an alum. I oftentimes pull out my transcript and I share it with students, and I'm like, many of you are much, much smarter than I was, and just, you know, we're all coming alongside on this journey, and it's just great fun.
What propelled you to get into the education side?
Well, I was just intrigued by this idea of kind of coming full circle back to BC. Part of the reason we came back to Bemidji was Marianne Reitmeyer, who was teaching at BSU in the social work program for a long time. She had reached out and said, hey, I'm going on sabbatical. Are you interested in doing some adjunct teaching? And so we sort of circled back to, yep, we were ready to move home. Our kids were 1 and 3 at the time and wanted to be close to grandparents. And I was really intrigued by this opportunity to teach at BSU. By the time we made it all happen, it was too late to do that, but I started adjunct teaching shortly after we came back here and just really enjoyed it immensely. Okay. Yeah. Now I'm doing some projects actually across campus, so looking at taking some of these social work skill sets and pairing with STEM programs at making BSU STEM education a little bit more accessible to students from across the region, and taking some of those skills from social emotional learning. And I'd worked at Peacemaker Resources for a little while before coming to BSU, and looking at applying models for really resilience focused education across the campus so that we can really diversify our workforce and diversify and build our campus community in a really effective way.
And how long have you been the chair of the social works department?
For 2 years.
Well, being in the field, being in the education side, looking at society, what are our big challenges? What are you seeing as the biggest challenges?
One of the things I think that's the biggest challenge just for humanity is understanding, like, how do things happen? And so one of the things that I'm really passionate about is educating students about the World Health Organization developed this model called the Community Social Determinants of Health. And I think that it's imperative for our community to understand, like, how do things like homelessness happen in the first place? What are the origins of social inequities? I think that's one of the biggest challenges we have, is connecting the dots backwards and understanding collectively, how did we get here in the first place, so that we can then prevent these things from happening. So I would say that's probably our foremost challenge, is just really having a collective understanding of how did we get here in the first place. In this region, one of our biggest challenges is telling the story, like understanding our community well enough to be able to share the story with legislators, with policymakers, with people who make a difference, so that we're not just spinning our wheels, but we're really making an effective difference targeting these things that contribute to health inequities and social inequities.
Are there still a large number of students interested in this field?
There are. Social work, I'm really proud to say, our hybrid program grew by 80% since 2019.
Wow.
Now that is, you know, during a time on campus when we've seen the biggest enrollment decline post-pandemic, and our on-campus numbers are down 30%, our hybrid numbers are up 80, so we're 50 to the plus as far as I'm concerned. But we need more social workers. I want young folks out there to know that there's just a really vast career full of opportunities, and opportunities to make a difference in the world, career opportunities. And so we're really Yeah, I want local students to be showing up now that we're seeing this growth with our hybrid program. I think it's important for our local youth to know that there are a lot of career opportunities beyond what people might traditionally think of as a social work career.
And am I right to you've been working on that?
I am working on that. I love working on that. So I reach out. We're working on setting up career days in the middle school and the high school, and we're also working on just partnering with local agencies to get out there and share stories with our young, you know, up-and-coming students about what social work looks like. So one of our most current ideas is to create, Emily Payne has created a human library experience as part of one of the classes in our social work program. And so my hope is that we can develop this human library of social workers that can be an experience for middle school and high school students to have during these career days, so they can kind of check out a social worker and learn about, you know, what kind of a career trajectory they have had, and get them more excited about the potential for a social work career.
So what would you say is the biggest stereotype or misconception about social work?
I think the biggest stereotype is that, you know, we take children away from their parents, and we all work in Child Protective Services. And the reality is, some people work in Child Protective Services, and that's a huge need in this region. But there are just so many different, you know, I've always worked in agency administration as a social worker. I've never actually been a case manager before. There are macro level jobs, there are policy change jobs, there are school social work jobs. One great thing about a social work career, or degree anyway, is that you get your degree in 4 years. You can get a master's degree in 1 year with an undergraduate degree in social work. Any other human service degree, you have to go to 2 years for a master's degree. But in social work, you can get your master's degree in 1 year. So there's a huge time and financial savings for students there. Also, we're licensed at the undergraduate level. So a lot of times I'll get calls from students who got a degree in another human service profession saying, I need to get licensed as a social worker. Can I transfer my classes over? I'm like, sorry, you know, it doesn't work that way. You have to actually get the social work degree. So it's one of the most employable degrees that students can get at the undergraduate level because of that licensure. So there are two things there, that 4+1 for that master's degree, and the master's degree in social work is what can help people be a clinical social worker. If they want to be a therapist, they want to work with youth, that's the degree to have. So it's the fastest route to that degree, in addition to it's the most broad and broadly applicable degree you can get as an undergraduate for working with families, communities, organizations, groups, you name it.
So, you know, when you watch cop shows, right? Yeah. And they go talk to the social service people and they're all burnt out. They got way too many cases and there's no hope. I mean, that's the stereotype you see on a show.
Stereotype as well, yeah.
And then, fortunately for me, I get to either be on the allocations committee or the community investment council, as we call it now, or do the Living United and talk to these people. I go, these people are not like that at all.
No. I think that's, you know, that is definitely a misconception. And I always tell folks, you know, I get to see some of the most amazing transformations. Like, you know, that's a huge benefit of this job. When you're working alongside an organization or with a family or an individual, and you get to be, you know, in that front row seat to the life of somebody who's really making a huge transition or change, or an organization that's going through a huge transition or change, that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And it's fun. It's completely satisfying. So I think every job you have has its hard points, and I am certainly glad I chose this career.
Your hands-on experience, mainly in homelessness, which continues to be an issue. What is the biggest challenge that you see? What is there a specific cause to homelessness? I know there's a lot of stories out there, but is there one that seems to be a little more common than others?
Well, in my community practice class, I have students do a capstone project around the community social determinants of health. And it's always fascinating to me. So they all get to choose the injustice that they want to focus on, whether it's homelessness, whether it's addictions, it might be child abuse and neglect. the connecting dots backward activity finds all of these injustices and social inequities have one common denominator, which is poverty. And really looking at, you know, the sources of poverty, those are varied, and they're largely, you know, we can point to social policies such as inequitable funding of school districts. So kids who are, you know, going to school in rural communities with really inadequate funding in those schools have a much higher chance of living in poverty throughout their lifetime as opposed to schools in higher income districts. We can be looking at things like minimum wage policies, social policies that have kept people in that cycle of poverty over and over again. I actually talked to the child protection workers and asked them that question, like, what can we do to stop this cycle of poverty, abuse, neglect? And one of them had a brilliant idea, and he said, we need to get the activities bus back. My kids that I work with on my caseload, they can't access after-school activities because they don't have an activities bus anymore. And so it's a social policy there. So almost always poverty is connected to all, you know, a wide array of social policies. And I think the beauty in this work is looking at what are those policies. I called the school district and I said, what would it cost to get the activities bus back? That's about $150,000 a year. That's doable, you know. So I know, but we also have an inequitable transportation policy as a state. So if you look at the state transportation policy, it favors the Twin Cities metro areas, and it disfavors us to the tune of about $2.5 million. So again, another social policy that continues to contribute to that cycle of poverty. So understanding that poverty is a common denominator, and then looking at all of those policies that affect poverty generationally is the key to looking at what can we do to solve this. So anybody listening has got that extra $150,000 sitting around, let's get that activities bus back.
I love it. What drives you to do all this, to do the work you do?
I think that I became a social worker really, really early in life, and I tried to kind of pretend I wasn't for a long time. Grew up with two siblings with disabilities, so I had this front row seat to what oppression and inequity looks like. And but, you know, I took this kind of roundabout approach to it with my political science degree, which I'm really glad I did, because I think that contributed to a comfort level in working with Frank Moe and looking at things from more of a policy perspective. So it's a nice combination, being a lifer as a social worker, to have that background as well. But yeah, I think largely my sister and brother are both deaf. So we had a multicultural family. We spoke two languages in our household, and, you know, we sort of stood out like a sore thumb in a small town. And when my siblings were going to school, there weren't a lot of services for them. They had to be bused to a different community. They ended up going to the state school for the deaf. And I just, you know, I've watched over the course of our lives how things have unfolded very differently for all of us because of the simple fact that I was born hearing and they were born deaf.
Well, Rebecca Hoffman is the faculty chair of the Social Work Department at Bemidji State University. Would we call you the founder of the Village of Hope?
You would.
Okay. That seems like a fair title. Today, anything else?
Thank you for letting us interview you. You are, like I said, somebody I admire and really appreciated hearing your story.
Thanks so much.
It is the Legendary Women of Beltrami County, a series we're doing in Women's History Month on Living United, the United Way podcast. And today, we'll have another great story next time.
Yes, we will.